everybody. Happy New Year and all that. Now that it's January 2008, we here at theoneliner.com thought we might look back and discuss the films we liked the most and the films we liked the least of 2007. Yeah, anyway, it's time to unleash some truth on the cinematic year that was 2007. So, regardless of whether you're ready or not, we're going to take that mofo down. We've kind of come up each with a list of our top 10 favourite films, which we are going to discuss. We might also throw in there, we might have a little discussion about our least favourite films. And we'll be giving an honourable mention to some films which might not have been among the best of the year, but which deserve special credit for various purposes. But we'll come to those later on. We're going to start by asking Drew, who's joining us as usual from Falkirk, for his number 10 of 2007. Drew, what's that number 10 for you?
My number 10 film is the vampire film 30 Days of Night.
Excellent.
Which, while being a very good film in its own right, Silly makes the top 10 simply for being a horror film that was any good at all. Which makes it quite unique nowadays.
It's the snow leopard of films. A very rare thing indeed. And what did you like most about it, Drew?
It was just a horror film that was actually disconcerting. It was well acted. The atmosphere was wonderful. The sound design is deeply unnerving, and it just, I can't really give it any higher praise, and it's a horror film that didn't suck, other than in this vampiric way, obviously.
That's it. Well, let me tell you, folks, it might not necessarily have been, I wouldn't have said it was scary per se, very few horror films are these days, but as Drew points out, the fact that it wasn't crap pretty much makes it an Oscar contender as far as horror films are concerned. Yeah, if you look at any horror film in the last 5 years.
Yeah, not scary, it's unsettling though. Some of it. Unsettling. Sound design, unsettling for certain.
Absolutely. Scott, does it appear on your list?
It didn't quite make my list. It was one of the kind of bubbly under ones I'd considered and just missed out. But yeah, it's a very good film, very tense. One of the more tense films I've seen this year. Great atmosphere. I think I've compared it to some of the earlier Carpenter stuff when we spoke about it last, and yeah, very good film. Certainly the coveted winner of the least worst horror film of the year award.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's not on my top 10 films of the year again, but it was one that I wanted to give an honourable mention to later on for the reasons we've just discussed. It is quite reminiscent of earlier John Carpenter stuff. I wouldn't say it's as good as something like The Thing, but it does draw on stuff like that for inspiration, and it's not incredibly original, but it does work very well indeed, and it is very unsettling. Scott, what have you got at number 10?
Number 10, just sneaking in, is Zodiac, which I can't remember if we discussed before.
I don't think we did.
I was swithering about whether to put this on. It is, I think, a good film. Mostly David Fincher's one of our favourite directors, I think that's fair to say.
Absolutely.
While this is one of probably the most restrained Fincher film I've seen, there's only a couple of moments where it actually sort of feels like a Fincher film. For me, it's kind of like his straight story. It's proven that he can do a proper dammer. If you're going to make one criticism about Fincher, it's that he's all about sort of impact and things like Fight Club, things like Seven. It's all geared up towards that first viewing, and after that, although they're still good films, they're still very enjoyable films, it's not going to have the same punch. Zodiac only really fails in the sense that it's because it is based on the Zodiac killings, which haven't been solved. It can't give you any answers at the end. And even though it does attempt to give you one, it has a very clear idea of who did it, and it sort of points you in that direction. I felt that was a bit forced, actually. That's probably the least favourite thing about it. But yeah, other than that, it's a good film, great performances by Gyllenhaal, and Anthony Edwards is one of the cops. I thought it was an enjoyable film. It's arguably a little overlong, but yeah, a very enjoyable experience.
I thought Zodiac was pretty good, but like you say, this is the ending. I would have preferred it to be a little more ambiguous. But again, a lot of audiences, I think, were turned off by the fact that, you know, the bad guy doesn't take a bullet in the head. We need to know who's done it, and we need to see him pay.
Yeah.
Well, go away. We're fed up with that sort of jazz. I thought it was very good, very competent. There wasn't as much of the usual Fincher sort of completely unnecessary yet hugely expensive effect shots. You know, there were no zooms out of trash cans, completely CG trash cans like Fight Club. There was none of that stupid panic room stuff of bloody CG banisters and shit like that, which that's my criticism of Fincher. He sort of tends to, I think he likes to think he pushes the envelope of banister and waste paper basket CG, and it's not really necessary, David. I think maybe he's learned. It's either that or someone took his budget away. But whatever the reason, Zodiac, I quite enjoyed it. It's not in my top 10, but I thoroughly enjoyed it. Drew, did you have any feelings one way or another about Zodiac?
Well, mostly my thoughts have been mirrored by you two, so I see no need to add anything.
Excellent news. At number 10 on my list, now I've done mine in no particular order, but this film has just squeezed into my top 10, and it's only been on repeated viewing on DVD that I've actually come to feel this way about it, was Sunshine. I don't know how you guys feel about it. I wasn't all that impressed at the cinema. I thought it stuck well. I was impressed to begin with. I thought the first hour of it was actually very, very good, and it was let down by quite a poor final couple of reels. However, having watched it since on DVD, I'm actually more taken with it, and I'm actually a bit more proud of it as a piece of British sci-fi filmmaking. Didn't have the hugest budget in the world, but I think it was certainly one of the best looking films of last year. I thought there were some good performances, and it did manage to again be relatively unsettling. And while I would still say the ending isn't ideal, I feel it settles in a lot, beds in a lot better on repeat viewing. And I don't know, there were some touches in there, although it borrows heavily from pretty much every sci-fi film that's ever been released, and no doubt Danny Boyle would like to say, oh, it tips its hat towards them. Well, no, it blatantly rips them off. But it's done very well. The production design's fantastic, and I actually think it's quite a solid little film.
I guess I kind of agree with what you were saying at the start there. For about an hour, I thought it was really good, but then it turns into a sort of third-rate slasher film, and I just sort of tuned out. The only difference between you and me, I think, is that I've never actually been intrigued enough to go back and watch it again, and to be honest, I don't think I ever will. Certainly would be nowhere near my top 10, but yeah, I mean, the first hour does have a lot of things in it that I did enjoy, that I did like, but you know, the ending just killed it for me, to be honest.
Yeah, Drew?
I had been, like Scott, I'd been enjoying it for a while, up to the point it turned into a slasher film, and really I lost all interest. I've only seen it the once in the cinema, but I have had no inclination to watch it on DVD at all.
No, I would be interested to see what you think, actually, in repeat viewing, because I've watched it a couple more times now, and I am... This may be a little quirk of my own, but I really begin to quite enjoy it. There's probably other films I could have put in there at the bottom of my list over and above Sunshine, but I just feel like waving the flag a little bit. So there you go. Drew, what would you have at number 9 on your list?
At number 9, I've got two films, actually, because I couldn't decide between them. But...
you cheat.
Well, when you hear what the two are, you'll see it's not cheating so much, but the two films are Super Bad and Knocked Up, and both from the same production team, both with a lot of the same cast and both equally bloody funny, and I simply couldn't decide between them. So at number 9 I have both Super Bad and Knocked Up.
Well, they're not bad choices. I mean, certainly you'll have Super Bad in my list a bit later on, which I think I went through the same kind of selection procedure and just picked Super Bad. I thought it was a little funnier than Knocked Up. It appealed to me a little more. It's a kind of strange mixture of coming of age stuff, and it's odd. I mean, it is bad taste, but it doesn't actually feel bad taste. It's the same thing that happened with 40-Year-Old Virgin, where it's a lot of things that if you'd given... I mean, it's not much different in script from, say, American Pie in terms of concept, but it's just shows what difference a bit of talent makes.
Absolutely, yeah. It's a sort of the equivalent of that. I like to think of, as you know, that relative, that regardless of how maybe your parents feel about bad language, there's always one relative in the family who throws expletives about a bit, you know, maybe an uncle or something, but somehow they get away with it. People just aren't offended by them. It's that because of their character, they can get away with all the expletives under the sun and nobody tends to bat an eyelid. It's that kind of a film. I could well have... Superbad was one of the choices I could have had in at my number 10 position, actually. And like you, Scott, I preferred it. I didn't actually think all that much of Knocked Up, to be honest. I did enjoy it, but not to a huge extent. But Superbad I really did enjoy. I think it's probably our generation's equivalent of... Well, I say our generation, we've probably passed it now. It's the current generation's equivalent probably of something like Porky's or something like that. Whereas we had American Pie, I think, you know, this will be the next thing. I don't particularly take any ownership of American Pie because I thought it was rubbish.
I think Dazed and Confused was the film I was thinking more of, that kind of
Dazed and Confused, there you go. Yeah,
a bit more respectable there.
Yeah, a bit more respectable. It's maybe a bit too much Gen X though, whereas I think Superbad's probably more commercial than that, but it is bloody funny. It's bloody good, and it's obviously had some care and attention lavished on it, and it somehow manages to walk a tightrope between being quite obscene and at the same time quite charming, and I thought it was actually very endearing, strangely enough.
Yeah, I think the problem is something like American Pie, a lot of the stuff is bad taste, but it's not funny. When it's bad taste and funny, you sort of forgive it.
Yeah, absolutely.
But of course, it introduced the world to McLovin.
McLovin is awesome. McLovin is our god.
McLovin. I wouldn't be surprised if McLovin becomes the most popular name for newborns in 2008. Off the back of Superbad.
I just mentioned it because I had said Knocked Up as well. I just found them, probably Superbad had the edge slightly, but I've enjoyed them both immensely. I found them both very funny, and Knocked Up pulled off the rather unique trick of it being a romantic comedy with a what was another film could be a sort of sickly sentimental ending that was actually, it fitted the film well and was quite pleasing rather than drowning in sugar.
Yeah, definitely.
Which
definitely
rather pleased me.
Yeah, quite an honourable mention, I suppose, to them both, because is it just me actually? We always give horror films a hard time, but it's quite rare actually to find a good comedy these days as well, isn't it?
There's a lot less of them made. I seem to be exposed to more terrible horror than I am a terrible comedy, but that's not to say there aren't terrible comedies, which we'll cover later, no doubt.
No doubt.
I think you'll find yes we shall.
Scott, what was it, your number 9?
I'll take a moment just to mention that for most of this top 10, you could reorder it into anything you like. I don't know how you can compare Superbad and Zodiac and say that.
That's why I didn't bother putting mine in order.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say there's probably two films that are head and shoulders above everything else, but the rest of it you can more or less put in any order you like. I'll also mention a couple of things that I think might have been on this list had I actually got round to seeing them, because there's a couple of notable omissions. The Kite Runner's been getting decent reviews, but I've not got around to seeing that yet. Things like The Fountain were released, which is kind of an oddball thing, but I think it might appeal to me, but again, haven't seen it.
Yeah, definitely.
The new David Lynch film, Inland Empire, I assume would probably feature on this list, given my inclinations. Things like The Darjeeling Limited.
I've got Inland Empire. I think you would very much enjoy it. I didn't like it as much as Mulholland Drive, but I think you would like it.
There's probably some notable omissions you can take offence at, but it's probably just more a lack of time on my part than anything else. Number 9 on my list is actually an older film that's only just crept on the wire for a cinematic release in the UK. It's a documentary called Jesus Camp, which is horrifying more than any horror film I've ever seen. It's basically covering one of these Bible Belt camps where parents can send their 6 and 7 year old kids to be effectively brainwashed into becoming Catholic little soldiers, and it's really quite terrifying to watch. Very well made. It's one of the less op-ed of the documentaries. It shies away from the whole Michael Moore thing of inserting a visible face to it. It's more giving them a rope to hang themselves with, and boy do they hang themselves with. Definitely worth seeing. I mean, I don't really want to get into sort of wars on religion here, but I have very little patience with people who will try and bring up kids into a particular faith when it's something you really have to come up with by yourself. It's not something you can sort of batter into people as children. I don't think that's fair. I don't think that's right to take advantage of children that don't have the critical faculties to decide whether what they're being taught is nonsense or not. And this is just one of these things that make my blood boil.
Can I say thank you, Scott? Can I just cut and say thank you, because there will be someone who will listen to this podcast at some point, and I made that very same point to them, and I don't think they thought I was thinking straight. Well, not that they didn't think I was thinking straight, but they disagreed with me, and I agree with you wholeheartedly.
There is a difference between teaching people about religion and just brainwashing them and saying this is the truth because it is the truth. When I found out I was actually going to get religious education at school, I was slightly offended until I found out that for the most part it is just saying, well, this is what these people believe, this is what these people believe, this is what these people believe, and that's fine. It's when you're told what to believe that I start getting a bit uppity, and if you start subjecting 6 and 7 year old kids to that, it's a bit...
Which is my argument why children should not be baptised until they are old enough to decide for themselves.
Yes, well,
absolutely.
So yeah, it's definitely worth seeking out. You'll be able to find it, no doubt, in DVD by this point. I've not checked, so I'm sure it must be out in DVD by this point, and it's very well worth watching. Although I think I saw it in 2006, it is the best documentary to come out this year in the UK.
I would like to make a point before I go on also that there are obviously other films which I have no doubt I would probably massively enjoy, but I have not got round to seeing yet, one of which is Tell No One. I don't know if you guys seen it.
I have, yeah. Yes.
Was it worthy of a top 10 inclusion?
No.
No, right, okay.
It's good, but it's not that good.
It certainly made my list of things that I briefly considered then discarded. It's good enough to be on a short list, but probably not to be in a top 10.
Fair enough, that's grand. I should also point out to listeners as well that 2007, of all the years that I have been a member of the Cinema Going Public, I have perhaps seen the least in the cinema this year, certainly since we started doing the website and since I started my life anew 250 miles from home. I don't get as much time these days. So in at number 9, I don't know how you feel about this, The Simpsons Movie.
No, I considered that. Simply, again, you hear me saying this a lot today, I suspect, but just simply, it was bloody funny.
It's not as good as The Simpsons Movie should have been, but it was still funnier than almost everything else I saw this year.
And I think a lot of people felt that, including myself, that were sort of disappointed it wasn't just making us cry with laughter. It was just as good as any good Simpsons episode. You just felt for a film it should have been more, but yeah, it's still better than pretty much anything else that's come out in the genre over
as
the year.
As far as, I mean, a lot of TV programmes get film, the film treatment, and they always struggle with the problem of being You know, the format doesn't fit. They don't expand well to fill a 90-minute sort of...
Yeah, they have to almost sustain in a story over the time. Yeah,
absolutely, and normally they fall flat on their backside. And with the Simpsons movie, I didn't feel that happened as much. I felt it sustained itself reasonably well, but it was just a very funny episode of The Simpsons, but longer. It wasn't the genius I expected after so many years.
Here's a slightly weird thing, I think. It's not in my top 10, because I think I've got two comedies in there that made me laugh more in a cinema. However, yep. I suspect if you come back to me in about 5 years' time, I'll remember The Simpsons more. I've probably seen that more on repeat viewing, and it sort of remains consistently funny. Whereas I think things like Superbad, while I thought it was great first time I saw it, I think I'm going to not find myself laughing quite so hard and quite so long at it for all the rest of the times. Whereas The Simpsons, if history and the television series then to go by, will keep me laughing like a drain 10, 15 years down the line. A very strong contender, like I say. It doesn't quite make my list for some bizarre reason, but yeah, I think if you come back to me in 10 years' time, it'll probably be more like, it might make a top 10 of this decade, I think.
I suspect it might have legs, that film.
Drew, what do you have at number 8?
Number 8, I had Michael Clayton, a film about sort of problem fixer lawyer played by George Clooney and him exposing various nefarious deeds.
Scott, can you elaborate any further on Michael Clayton? Did it make your top 10?
No, I don't think I'd even consider this one, to be honest. Not a particularly bad film. There's things I liked in it. George Clooney's never less than affable to watch on the screen. I think what I liked about it was the fact that while he was a bit kind of slightly shady and evil character at the start, he doesn't really go through any massive changes and become a better person at the end of it, which is quite a kind of a trite way. It's just someone tries to stitch him up. So he stitches the person who was trying to stitch him up. It kind of felt a bit more realistic to me in that sense. But it's an enjoyable little romp, but I wouldn't bother my top 10 list, I don't think.
What do you have residing at number 8 then?
Number 8 for me is Hot Fuzz, which again, Simon Pegg does something, and this time Simon Pegg does action films but in a sleepy little village, and again it's just there because it's really, really funny. Probably not too much more that I want to say about this, but it's just a deeply funny film that I really enjoyed watching.
It also stands up to repeat viewing. I've seen it at least twice since I saw it in the cinema, and it's been just as funny every time.
Yeah, definitely. I had some issues with Shaun of the Dead. I've seen it a couple of times since, and I've maybe enjoyed it more, but I still don't think it's a work of genius some people are inclined to think. I still don't think Hot Fuzz is a work of genius, and the last sort of, I don't know, the last 20 minutes of it's just maybe lets the rest of the film down. But I did enjoy it. No, I didn't enjoy it enough to make it in my top 10, but I certainly enjoyed it more than Shaun of the Dead, and I did think it was quite another sort of solid film.
Yeah, certainly better than Shaun of the Dead.
No, I thought it was a pretty strong contender for British comedy, maybe, of the year.
Yeah, I can't think of anything better than it that we've made from in these shores.
I've got at number 8 this is in no particular order, The Lives of Others, which... along with one other film on my list was, well, I don't class American cinema as foreign film, which being a Brit I should, but from countries other than Britain or the US, it's one of two films on my top 10 that I really enjoyed this year. And I don't know, I've not been as impressed by German cinema. German cinema seems to be getting a fair bit of exposure at the moment in the international scene. I did really enjoy Downfall, not as much as some other people, but I saw Goodbye Lenin. Didn't think it was all that great. But Lives of Others really stuck out for me this year. It manages to fit one of the strangest, most heartwarming endings into about the last 5 seconds of the film, which if you see it, you'll probably know what I'm talking about if you have a heart or a soul at all. Did you guys see The Lives of Others?
It's just fantastic. It's brilliantly acted. It's got a great storyline, heartwarming ending. Really, could find no fault with that film at all.
Yeah, it's nice to see things that you don't really know too much about, not that, and don't know all that much about the Stasi way into it. So it was a very good film to watch from that perspective. Kind of the dark side of the coin of Goodbye Lenin, which was a kind of light-hearted, jaunty way to look at the Eastern Germany, whereas this one mostly shows you the dark side of it.
They do share a similar sort of concept. Don't know, they're strange bedfellows, but I suppose one in a strange way they do complement each other. But I just think this had one of the best central performances I've seen, not even internationally. I just think it's one of the best central performances I've seen all year, to be honest with you. And I thought it was quite a gallant central performance as well, because the character is not intended to be likeable for the entire film, apart from the last 5 seconds, as I say, which completely turns your perception of the character on its head. And I don't want to say I was absolutely blown away by The Lives of Others, but certainly probably it would be my top 3 films of the year. It's just that I haven't done this list in any particular order. So
yeah, it's like the unfortunate sad thing is, having seen The Lives of Others, I'd very much like to have seen more of the actor, but he died recently.
Yeah, absolutely, which is quite a loss, actually, it would appear. Be interesting to see if the Academy throws him a sort of a posthumous biscuit this year.
I can't think of anything that would be more deserving of it, to be honest.
No, neither can I. Drew, what do you have residing at number seven?
Number seven, I have Hot Fuzz, which we have, of course, already discussed.
Fair enough. And Scott, what do you have at number seven?
Number seven gets Eastern Promises, the latest Cronenberg outing, which we think we spoke about this before. It's a very, very good companion piece, I suppose, to History of Violence, which I thought I preferred a little bit more this over History of Violence. Again, another strong performance from Viggo Mortensen, and a very interesting look at the Russian mafia underworld in the underbelly of London. Again, it's a fairly sedate thing, followed by moments of brutal violence, which I seem to be enjoying in films these days. Yeah, just one of my more enjoyable films that I've seen in the cinema.
I think the enjoyment comes from the fact that Cronenberg treats violence differently to almost any other director currently working in Hollywood, I think. Mm-hmm. There's no glamorisation whatsoever. He doesn't shy away, but it never feels gratuitous either. It is an absolute cliche to say that, oh, you know, it's only there to, as part of the story, that's an essential part of blah, blah, blah. But with Cronenberg, you can pretty much be sure that that's a genuine statement, and I've yet to see a Cronenberg film where it's not entirely justifiable in the context, and the fact that he does actually use it quite sparingly. As films tend to be these days, oh, you know, it's so brutally violent. Well, when it happens, it is, but it's not like it's happening every 5 minutes. There are maybe, what, three instances of violence in the whole film?
If that, yeah.
If that, you know, two or three instances of violence in the whole film. And he doesn't shy away from much, no, but, well, apart from one, they're over pretty quickly. And they're all the more affecting for it. And in a day and age where everybody's so desensitised, yeah, it makes a big difference. It's quite refreshing, actually.
That's one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much, in that, you know, the violence is brutal, but it's absolutely not gratuitous. It's necessary to the story and to the world that it depicts. And because it's so realistic looking too, it's the more shocking for it in a desensitised world, but more effective too.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually quite surprised every time I see a Cronenberg film now that he does still manage to sort of shock me a bit, because I kind of feel like we're beyond being shocked now, but it's nice to know that you're not. Maybe in a strange way, Cronenberg's films may remind us that we're actually, you know, they make us feel quite human. Who knows? Maybe I'm looking into it too deeply. Number seven, again, waving a bit of a flag here. I've got The Last King of Scotland, which I enjoyed phenomenally, and I thought, I'm not a huge James McAvoy fan. I find him a bit pretentious, but I certainly can't fault Forest Whitaker's performance as Idi Amin. And while he doesn't resemble him physically, what a terrifying performance. What an absolutely unhinged performance he gives him. It was absolutely fantastic.
One of the most powerful performances I've seen in a good long time. Whitaker is brilliant. He manages to play exactly why Idi Amin would have been so popular. You see, he's charming, he's smart, he seems likable, but then there's always just that undercurrent of menace, which he just managed to do so well.
You say menace, I say psychosis. Oh, goodness gracious. I mean, if it weren't for Whitaker's performance, I don't think I would probably have this in my top 10. But the fact is, Forrest Whitaker is in it. His performance is phenomenal, and it is in my top 10.
And his Oscar was massively well deserved for it. It's just such a powerful performance, and the power radiating off him all seems to come out of the screen.
Absolutely. What's your number six, Drew?
Number six is The Bourne Ultimatum.
Excellent.
I suspect I don't need to explain to any of our listeners what it's about. I just say that while the filmmakers tried to claim that the thing they had over Bond was that they weren't formulaic, and this is a bit, it's still a deeply enjoyable film, excellent performances, and it's just very, very slickly done.
Very, very top little thriller. Very enjoyable.
I thought it was very slick. The only gripe I had with it, and I think I raised it when we first spoke about it in the podcast, is that it's just seems to copy and paste huge chunks from The Bourne Supremacy.
Yes, I'm saying it has become a bit formulaic. Bond does that.
Well, that's not formulaic. I mean, I'm talking about it literally copies and pastes.
Ah, yes, especially the car chase.
The car crash bit at the end, yeah.
The car chase from, it is pretty much the Moscow car chase from The Bourne Supremacy.
Absolutely.
Cut and pasted with a different car added. And even it ends in an almost identical manner.
Yeah, whether that's intentional for effect, I'm not entirely sure. I can't think why it would be, but it also seems a bit too blatant to just be, you know.
Got to wonder whether perhaps they're saying, like, because he's stuck in this life, because of his brainwashing and not knowing who he is, he keeps repeating the same thing over. And I wondered whether perhaps that's what they're trying to say, but I'm not absolutely convinced.
Too deep, I think that's too deep for it, yeah. But no, I thought of all the sort of action stroke thrillers out this year, it was most definitely, it was head and shoulders above the rest. And again, it's not a 5-star film, but it was bloody enjoyable, and it's probably the best paced action film I've seen in a long time.
The only thing that I did enjoy about it was the ending. The whole trilogy essentially being a quest for Bourne's identity. When he finally finds out, it's a complete anticlimax.
Well, absolutely. You don't really learn much more than you learned in The Bourne Supremacy anyway, do you?
Not an awful lot, no.
No, not enough to justify a whole separate film. And as you say, when it does come, it's a bit of an anticlimax. But if you can, you know, if you can ignore that, I still think the rest of the film gives you your sort of £7 worth.
Absolutely. As an action film, yeah, you can't fault it.
Yeah, it's the kind of film that comes along and says, well, actually, now and again, it is worth paying that kind of a price to get into a cinema these days. So well done to all involved. Scott, what's your number six?
Number six, I have Superbad, which you've probably covered enough debt, but yeah, very funny film.
Yeah, I would concur. My number six, I don't think either of you, I don't know, maybe you have seen it since. I don't think you caught it in the cinema, though. Jindabyne. Have you caught up with it yet?
Haven't, no.
No.
No. Well, you'll just have to take my word for it then. It's very good. It's directed by Ray Lawrence, who brought us Lantana a couple of years back, Australian filmmaker. And it's another one of these sort of slow-burning films which not a lot happens in. It's more focused on relationships. And I just thought it was a nice change of pace from some of the rest of the stuff over the summer, where we had robots and half-man, half-spiders and all that jazz stomping about all over the place. I just thought Jindabyne was a nice release from it all, to be honest. I don't think I saw anything this summer that I enjoyed in terms of blockbusters. And so it was quite nice just to sit back in a seat and watch a nice, you know, well, it's not a nice film. A film which takes its time. It's very character-driven. It's got consummate performances and can't really praise it high enough. It's not one for the action crowd, put it that way. But if you like a bit of thought on your plate every now and again to digest, then highly recommended. Drew, what do you have at your number five?
Number five, I have The Last King of Scotland, which, of course, we just discussed. So nothing more stuff to add to that.
Scott, what's your five?
Boringly, The Bourne Ultimatum.
Well, boringly enough, my number five is Hot Fuzz. Shall we discuss that? Drew, have you got anything different at number four?
Number four, I have Shane Meadows' This Is England.
Gasp.
So do I. Excellent stuff, yeah. Is that what you have at four as well, Scott?
Indeed, yes.
That was one of my contenders for the top 10, actually. Again, one of the ones that just sort of kind of got nudged out. But I was actually quite impressed. It's not his best film. I would still say Dead Man's Shoes holds that title. But I was very impressed by This Is England. I thought it was quite a unique film this year, and it was very agreeable.
That's a very powerful drama. I suppose anything where you start introducing small kids to neo-Nazis is going to have some amount of emotional resonance without having to try too hard. But
you hope it'd have some impact.
Yes.
I think it's a kind of timely reminder that skinhead culture for a while wasn't all about Nazism stomping about with Union Jacks, and it was
actually about the exact opposite of that.
Exactly, before being sort of hijacked as by nationalist elements, and again, it's a very powerful drama, some very good performances, even from the little kid whose name I've forgotten. But
Thomas Turgis. It's worth watching for Thomas Turgis alone. For such a young guy to have such a performance, it's staggering. Maybe some child actors, they're passable at least, but Thomas Turgis is fantastic. He acts well above his age.
Yes. Now, Scott, you had the same thing at number four, didn't you?
Yes.
I had Eastern Promises at four. Again, this is in no particular order on my part, in which case we jump to number three, Drew.
My top half are particularly in order, and at number three I had Eastern Promises.
Excellent stuff. And Scott?
Number three for me is The Last King of Scotland. This is where you start getting into order with it, I think. The Last King of Scotland only just sneaks in this year, the 12th of January. Yeah, very strong film, very good film, very powerful film, and I'm very pleased to have seen it. Very pleased to have the name Scotland attached to it in some way.
Absolutely.
Even if it's a crazy psychopath.
Yeah.
We'll
exactly.
Take what we can get.
Yeah.
At number three, some people might consider this a cheat, but it was basically the best thing I saw all year at the cinema. It's a film I've been in love with for some time now, and that was Blade Runner, represented here in its final cut. And given that it only opened on, I think, 6 screens for a limited run or something, basically essentially just to promote the DVD release, I don't suspect a lot of people got a chance to see it, but I did. And yeah, it was the best thing I saw this year, even if it is sort of 20, 25, 26 years old.
Yes, and I think it says a lot for both the remaining appeal of the film, the lasting appeal, and the fact that there were not a massive number of great films out this year. that even in the 6 screens it was in, it still outperformed a huge number of films that opened in several screens over the country.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll tell you something else as well, to actually, because obviously I wasn't able to see it on the big screen first time around because I was practically still embryonic. But by God, am I glad that I finally have got to see it on the big screen, because everything that you know about the presentation and the mood and the lighting, as you may have seen it on video, Laserdisc, DVD over the years, is only confirmed and amplified 100 times over by seeing it on a big screen. And the glory... I'm going to rant on a bit here. The glory of seeing this film in the proper format, as it was intended, in a fantastic print, which looks better than a lot of films shot and released this year. Oh, by Jove, I was excited to see it. And it just, it was like watching a whole new film again. Absolutely fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
Didn't get to see it myself, but it's one of these films that's become one of my favourite films after having seen it earlier on in my life, when I just don't think I was quite prepared enough for it and sort of hated it on the first couple of views. There's a few films like that, and 2001 I loathed the first couple of times I saw it, because it's, you know, you're watching it staying up late at night as you're about 12 years old and it's midnight it starts or something like that, and it just didn't have quite the critical faculties for it. But as I grew older and kind of appreciate it more, it is a wonderful little film.
Oh, there we go. You can live it vicariously through my ranting, Scott. I won't harp on any more about the fantastic, amazing, outstanding Blade Runner Final Cut. Go and buy it now. 5-disc version available on DVD, Blu-ray, and HD DVD. At number
you can
two,
pay by Warner Brothers.
I wish. At number two, Drew, you have.
Number two, I have the excellent German film The Counterfeiters. Following in the footsteps of films like Downfall, German cinema seems to be revisiting some of its more unsavoury past. Well, the country's past rather than the cinema's past, obviously. Although some of the things Leni Riefenstahl did, perhaps not so savoury. It's certainly German cinema's revisiting some of the country's more unsavoury past, and doing it with aplomb, too. It's the story of a bunch of Jewish prisoners of war, well, rather concentration camp prisoners, who are forced to try and forge US and British currency to try and initially affect the currency of their enemies and eventually to pay for the Nazi war effort. And it's just a truly great film.
Scott, what do you make of it?
Yeah, it's also my number two film, and my top two definitely are Head and Shoulders above everything else, and they're both German. Again, a very powerful film, definitely worth tracking down, definitely worth watching. Quite emotive in places. I felt more moved by this, I think, than more or less any other film this year. Yeah, obviously anything set in a concentration camp is going to do that to you. It's not a particularly pleasant time in human history, but yeah, a very great film.
My number two is The Bonnot Name. Again, this isn't in any particular order as far as I'm concerned. Well, no surprise then. At number one, you both have The Lives of Others.
Absolutely, yep. Best film I've seen this year, The Lives of Others.
Mm-hmm.
And how about your number one?
Well, my number one. Well, again, this isn't my number one film of the year. But I've thrown this into my top 10 films of the year just to stir it up a bit. And because it might not necessarily have won a place, but it has won the place as my most surprising enjoyed film of the year, and that would be Enchanted. Have you guys got around to seeing it yet?
No.
Not yet, no.
No. Bizarrely, surprisingly, one of the most entertaining films I've seen all year. And, well, I don't know what to say about it, really. It's kind of Disney poking a bit of fun at itself in a very entertaining way, in a very sort of knowing way, I suppose you could say. It's kind of Disney does postmodern, if you can believe that. Fantastic central performances. Well, I say fantastic central performances. I think Amy Adams in the female lead performance manages to be... she manages to encapsulate everything that classic Disney princesses are in terms of their stupendously sunny outlook on life and their expectations of everything being fantastic. And she manages to transpose that to a contemporary urban New York setting with all the follies that brings, and she manages to maintain that sort of sunny charm of things without being sentimental or crass. It's actually one of the surprise comic performances of the year. Really, really good. And it was just nice to see a family film, which wasn't a CG film about CG ants getting into crazy capers. It was actual live actors. It was a very classical in style, but with a modern twist. It was excellently performed. Some great songs in there, great score, good production values, and by Jove, don't you know, it was a family film that I actually very much enjoyed. So completely taken by surprise there.
Not seen Enchanted, so we're not going to comment on it, but obviously if you like it, I'm sure I will. IMDb plot keywords are just a constant source of comedy for me. This one's in particular, I mean, I don't know if this... Does this jibe with your the most important recollection of the film for you, Craig? Plot keywords of reflection, rug, Manhattan, New York, fish out of water, divorce attorney. Does that adequately sum up the keywords of it?
Strangely, it's not far off, actually. It should give you some ideas to quite how eclectic a little film this is. Yeah, if you like reflections, fishes out of water, and divorce attorneys, I can think of no film I would recommend more than Enchanted. What, just in no particular order, guys, shall we now launch on our usual barbed invective and napalm the entire area of the worst films of the year? Drew, in no particular order, unleash a hate bomb on one of your top three most crap films.
The one that I could put in at the top of a list would be Death at a Funeral.
Ooh, deal with it.
To quote Mark Kermode, everyone involved should be thoroughly ashamed of themselves. It's terrible. It's cringeworthily bad. It's achingly unfunny. It's make Hulk angry, me want to smash bad. It's just awful. I can't express how bad a film it is.
I can express how bad a film it is. It's a comedy that isn't funny.
It's probably worse than Sweet Home Alabama, which was our previous low watermark for comedies that weren't funny. And possibly could argue that it's one thing is like to act for comedy films, like zero acts to all the other numbers and maths. No, none of them other ones work without it, but still, I really wish I hadn't seen it. It's terrible, it's terrible, it's terrible, it's terrible, it's terrible. It's terrible! Oh, it's just so bad. Even thinking about it makes me feel ill.
It would be one of my worst films of the year. And again, it's like most of these things, a lot of terrible films that we won't mention, but this is one that at least you think might have had some hope going into. I mean, it's directed by Frank Oz, your little favourite Yoda friend, who has directed some good films in the past. I mean, this is the guy that gave us Bowfinger, which is still one of the few Steve Martin films that is actually any good. We did things like Little Shop of Horrors, which I was quite enamoured with as well. It's got a cast which, while it's not the cream of the British comedy corp, it's not a bad cast. You would think they might have some slight chemistry, rather than seeming like they're acting in completely different rooms in a vacuum. It manages to just ruin every single thing that it tries, and it is almost the opposite of funny, which is not really what you're looking for in a comedy.
Is it on your list of hated films also, Scott?
It is the worst film that I've seen in the last year, certainly.
I'm going to throw one into the mix, guys. I'm going to say Premonition. It's that least surprising of numbers. It's a bad Sandra Bullock film. Well, what do you expect? But it actually manages to be possibly the worst Sandra Bullock film I've seen, and for that reason alone, it deserves to be on anyone's worst films of the year list. It is horrendously disjointed. The first 10 minutes of plot have obviously been written down on a napkin, which has then been lost when it's come time to write the rest of the film, because none of it makes any sense. It's just the kind of thing that just shouldn't be allowed. There should be some sort of UN embargo in place at this point now on anything to do with Sandra Bullock. It is honestly the sort of thing that governments should be upset about. I just cannot tell you how stupid that film was, and you guys didn't see it, did you?
No, we read your thrilling exposé and decided to give that one a miss, I think.
Oh, yes,
give that a body swerve.
The only good thing I can say about it is a conclusive proof that there is no God, because he couldn't have allowed something like that to happen. Drew, give us another.
My next film that is one of the worst of the year is Babel. For all the hype that surrounded it.
Babel.
The whole premise being that one little action can affect lots of people's lives all around the world. And the whole film is predicated on that one idea.
Do you mean,
but
Drew,
it
that it's a little bit? It's a little bit like a butterfly in Peking flapping its wings, and a hurricane forming over the United States.
If only a hurricane had formed over the production office when they were considering making this film,
it would all be so much better.
Yeah, the whole film is predicated on this one idea, but the one idea doesn't work. Therefore, the film's fatally flawed, and it's just stupid. It's the most tenuous links between the different strands of the story, and you find yourself screaming at the screen about how stupid it is.
Yeah, I've wondered for a while exactly what photographic evidence that the director, Alexandro Gonzalo Inatu, or however you pronounce his name, has that's against every critic in the world that's making them give good reviews to his films, because they're terrible. It's very much like his last 21 Grams, which did the same sort of same non-linear nonsense, choppy editing and all that kind of thing. And this one manages something that I never thought possible of actually being worse and more irritating. When you finally find out what the supposed connection between these three stories, which, as far as I'm aware, before I went into this, pretty much every critic had been saying, oh, it's so delicately interwoven, it's a masterpiece of narrative, yada, yada, yada. When you find out exactly how tenuous the connection, that, in particular the story that's unfolding in Japan, is, it's laugh-out-loud funny.
You just get the impression that if it had been anyone other than Inarritu directing it, they probably would have set about it, saying how tenuous, how stupid, how unbelievable.
Yeah.
I suspect Sean Penn might have gone away with it, actually.
No, I couldn't abide 21 Grams, and it was only very reluctantly that I caught up with Babel on DVD and then promptly found that I had a new drinks coaster on my hands, because the disc certainly won't be going back in my DVD player again.
The only thing that's any good in it is Kate Blanchett gets shot.
Yes. That much we can condone. No, I just, Amoris Peros I quite enjoyed, but after that I just have no interest in the man's films at all. 21 Grams, I think when we went to see that at cinema, I'm correct in saying that it was one of the fabled Craig Fell Asleep films, isn't it? Which puts it up there with The Sin Eater. And also
and Underworld, I think, yeah.
Yeah, that's pretty much all you need to know. Ridiculous. I'm just getting fed up of all these films now, this man is the sort of held up as a shining example of modern filmmaking. It's, oh, you know, the whole tired, oh, everything's told in flashback. Oh, look how unrelated these stories are. Oh, wait a minute. Oh, there are all these little interconnecting fibres. Yeah. Oh, how clever is that? No, it's not clever, because you could take any three stories, any set of events, and if you've got an active enough imagination, you can create as many tenuous links as you want between them. That doesn't make it clever, doesn't make it good screenwriting, and I'm sorry, but...
This sort of style of film came to its logical conclusion in Memento, and everything after that has basically been living on borrowed time that it's not got.
I was fed up enough by the time Crash came out. Crash is another one of these, not the David Cronenberg affair, the other Paul Haggis one. Paul Haggis, that's who I was looking for. Again, fond over, no, tired of it now, it's rubbish, makes no sense. It's not an example of good filmmaking. It's bothersome, it's tiresome, it's pretentious. Go away, go and live in a cave, I don't know, sleep under the stars every night, hundreds of thousands of miles away from civilization, put yourself in a rocket, fly to the moon, don't ever come back. Fed up of it now, beat it. Scott, what else have you got on your list?
It's more Cate Blanchett. Notes on a Scandal. Which?
My ears are bleeding at the memory. But carry on, Scott.
Released to some fanfare, mainly on the back of Judi Dench's performance, and while it is a reasonable performance, that basically she plays an embittered lesbian teacher who's discovers that one of her teaching colleagues, who she's also got a bit of a crush on, is having an affair with one of the pupils, which turns into some kind of blackmail thing, and all sorts of shenanigans go on. It's a mildly interesting drama with some good performances and unfortunately unlikable characters. If you could separate that bit of its own, it's not particularly great. I don't think it deserved anything like the acclaim that it got, but I wouldn't be too upset about it. But it has a score by Philip Glass.
A score suggests that some sort of work had gone into it. It might have notes and instruments, Scott. It doesn't have a score. It has noise by Philip Glass.
No, it has notes. Two of them, which it uses continually, loudly, over the entire film. I've never been so overwhelmed by a soundtrack in my life. I mean, it's not used for dramatic effect, it's just used everywhere. I mean, there were points in this film, and I've never had this before, where I had to put my hands over my ears just to stop music. It's really quite remarkable and absolutely terrible. I've never seen a film that's been so comprehensively underwhelmed by one single element being so terribly bad. The score is so distracting, it is impossible to like this film. Obviously, there must be some people that like what Philip Glass does, otherwise he wouldn't still be doing what he does, but I've never heard anything so discordant, irritating, annoying.
It's not one where you're holding out for an isolated score option on the DVD, then.
Only if you could isolate the score and burn it.
I avoided this. To be honest with you, I wasn't that interested in seeing it in the first place, but after your comments about Philip Glass in your review, I just thought, no, I can do without that in my life. So I'm pretty sure that I'm glad I've avoided it, even though I will never truly know.
Yeah, I'd just like to add, for the purposes of our listeners too, that Scott is very much not exaggerating when he says he had his hands over his ears. I was in the cinema with him and he did. I was not far off doing it myself, because it was just so overscored sonically and undermined what wasn't a great film to begin with, but utterly undermined it with the painful score that leaves your ears bleeding. It hurt. Imagine that somebody tidied a score done by somebody putting their finger around a wine glass or running the nail down a blackboard was a good idea, and you've pretty much got the score for noticing a scandal.
Let's not give it any more time. I'm going to throw in on the crimes against humanity pile, The Hills Have Eyes 2, a needless remake of a sequel remake to a sequel, I forget how it goes. I never really liked the first Hills Have Eyes film way back from 1978, was it 1978, 77, something like that? Yeah, I've never held Wes Craven aloft as a great example of filmmaking at all in the horror genre. And there was no need for a remake of The Hills Have Eyes, and even less for that remake to have its own sequel. And Scott, you were with me at this one. Drew, were you there as well?
No, I point blank refused to watch it because I knew it would be awful when it was a West film. Yeah. Wes Craven was involved with it. That's against my religion, had I any.
I think Wes Craven and his son, I think, are responsible for this one, aren't they?
Yes, Jonathan.
In terms of the screenplay, yeah. And it's just, do you know, there's not a single redeeming element to it. It's absolutely horrendous in every possible respect. It offers nothing to the genre, and worse than that, it hides behind the pretense that it's making some sort of political comment. And I'm getting a bit fed up of it now, where for the longest time, any film, horror film or sci-fi film about an alien invasion or some sort of horrible, nasty creature running about, it's a meditation on the Cold War. It's all about Reds Under the Bed, right? Okay, well, that was growing tired. Now we've got Gulf War analogies. Land of the Dead got away with that. I know you guys didn't enjoy it quite as much as I did, but even at that, I thought, you know, it's quite terse to say this is some sort of comment on the Gulf War. Okay, it's a horror movie about zombies eating people. Even less of a claim can be laid to this by this film, which has got nothing to do whatsoever. Just because you have rabid monsters jumping out of caves in the desert and eating people doesn't mean you get to call it a meditation on the current conflict in the Gulf. It's not. It is simply a steaming pile of cack. Stop trying to masquerade as something you're not. You're already bad enough without heaping that kind of nonsense on yourself, because anyone with more than one brain cell can see that it is not a comment on anything other than how crap a filmmaker you are. Rant over. Scott, can you think of anything to add to that?
Well, it is a dismal film. I've been shying away from putting horror films on these lists because...
they're too easy, aren't they?
In any year, the worst film you're going to see is probably going to be a horror. And even then, we're talking about the horror films that were good enough to make it into a cinema. God knows what the direct-to-video stuff's like. The Hills Have Eyes 2 is probably as bad an example as you can think of. I mean, I don't think I was actually particularly offended by it, because pretty much as soon as I sat down, I started thinking about something else, and I can really barely remember anything of it.
Yeah, you had to be paying attention to be offended by it, I think, and in that sense, I did myself a big disservice, because I should have done the same, and I should have taken my Nintendo DS with me or something like that.
It joins the whole peon of dismal horrors like Resident. It's not ever been a bumper year for horror films. You've had one good one, and then you've had Resident Evil 3 and Black Sheep and all the rest of them that... I think we've discussed enough that we don't really need to go back into it, but yeah, Hills Have Eyes 2 certainly sucked.
This one just offended me more than any. Drew, what have you got? What's your remaining horrible film of the year?
And I give consideration to things like Black Sheep and Resident Evil 3, but as Scott said, they're just too easy a target. You expect them to be awful. And a couple other films that I was very disappointed by, Ghost Rider and Curse of the Golden Flower, which should have been better, could have been better. Spider-Man 3 as well, and Curse of the Golden Flower's colour palette being the visual equivalent of Notes on a Scandal's score, it being so unpleasant to endure. But my third worst film of the year would have to be number 23. Appalling.
No, this is interesting, because in the last podcast we did, you were saying how after The Proposition you thought, God, Danny Houston, where's this guy been hiding? I want to see everything that Danny Houston's in. And it occurred to me only after we recorded that podcast, wait a minute, what about the number 23?
Yes. While we were doing it, I was looking at his filmography on IMDb, and I must have blanked that out. The number 23 is awful. It's one of those films that's liked by people like The Butterfly Effect. Which says a lot, really.
It's a clever film for people who don't know what clever is.
It's a film for idiots, made by idiots.
Yes, it's a film for the clever people who read the news of the world.
Yeah. What bothers me about it, though, is it's rather frustrating. It's once again like Jim Carrey proving that when he tones down the clowning about, he can actually act. And it's shot in a way which is quite stylish. It's quite pleasant to look at simply from a stylistic point of view. but the content of the film is absolute drivel.
Scott, can you add anything to that tirade?
I described it in a review as a thin dribble of pish, and I think that's probably about as accurate as I can get to it. It is the sort of film that has, I mean, the novel that he's reading, the number 23 that the character's reading, is written by something called Topsy Kretz, which is later revealed to me, oh, top secret.
Oh, you're joking.
But it's just the way it's spread. It means that you weren't supposed to realise that until it was mentioned by one of the characters. Like, well, what do you think my IQ is? I mean, it's not actually the number 23. I'm bright enough to have tied my own shoelaces and get through the door. You're not playing to my level here. It's just that it's a dismal, stupid film that makes no sense whatsoever.
I just love all that explanation that Danny Houston gives of all these, where number 23 crops up, and, you know, the Mayan calendar predicted the end of the world in 2012. And, what do you get if you add those together? You get 32, that's 23 backwards. It's, well, yeah. Never mind the fact that it's not the number 20 and the number 12. It's the number 2012. It's that it's that kind of a thing. Do you know what? And guys, have you looked at your keyboard lately? Have you seen what numbers, you know, what number comes after 3 on your keyboard?
There's an excellent montage in it where it's a fellow jogging with a number 2, and then a guy with jogging with a number 3 on his back, like, jogs up next to him, thus making the number 23 rather than 2. And 3 in disparate things.
Coming to cinemas next year, the number 34.
Oh, and that's even worse.
Scott, what's your remaining hate fest?
I'm going to cheat and do two, because we mentioned Spider-Man 3 before, just in passing, and it's one of these deeply, deeply disappointing films. It's a horrible, horrible mess. There's far too much going on, and none of it is any good, and you just expect a lot better from it. I think we all feel much the same with that. Have you actually seen it, Craig?
What blew me away was the fact that, well, obviously the whole thing was a shambles, but also what a drop in quality of the effects took on this one as well.
Yeah, it was just deeply disappointing. I feel a little guilty putting this, because I did watch it happily enough, and it's not the worst film you'll ever see in the world, but it's certainly the biggest disappointment of the year. If we're going for films that I just hated more, Lions for Lambs, which unites Meryl Streep and Tom Cruise on the same frame, which is never a good thing.
Pretty much a harbinger of the end of the world, isn't it?
I mentioned this in a podcast before, but it's a horrible, preachy, nasty... It's one of these liberal films where it's just trying to batter you over the head with a message, and it's just so ham-fistedly done. Robert Redford should be very much ashamed of it. It's a horrible film. I can't think of any redeeming features. It features weak performances from everyone, I thought. And it's just one of these films where it just seems like Robert Redford preaching at you. He could have just wrote it in a magazine somewhere rather than actually put me through 2 hours of torture with this.
Presumably the entire sort of gross national product of a small African nation on it.
Yeah, and hiring these people to espouse his worldview. And that's basically what it is. It's Robert Redford's plan for the world. And I don't really care what Robert Redford's plan for the world is, thanks. It's a dismal film, and it's one of these films that just annoys me because other people liked it so much. It was another one film that was a lot of right-thinking people did hate it, but it did get some reasonable acclaim, and it's a dismal film, and I can't understand what anyone would see in it. It's a juvenile high school newspaper op-ed piece with Tom Cruise in it. No thanks.
I had Spider-Man 3 down also, and it seems unfair to pick on it twice. So another big disappointment to me was The Brave One, which I only caught up with recently. And to be fair, when you have an actress like Jodie Foster and you have a director like Neil Jordan, you would expect at least something that stands head and shoulders above most of the rest of the stuff that came out in the year. Yeah. But instead, it's the most hackneyed, stupidly plotted, terse revenge thriller you've ever seen. And it struck me as being one of the dumbest movies in the world. And I thought, has Jodie Foster actually read the script to this? Because, you know, what intrigued me as well is there's a rip-off of that scene in Taxi Driver where Travis Bickle's bought his guns and he's right, I'm going to go out and avenge stuff. And then he just happens to be in a convenience store when someone comes in and starts kicking off and gets a chance to shoot them. And it's that sort of thing, but repeatedly in The Brave One. Jodie Foster, for those of you who don't know, she is attacked and put in a coma or something, I don't know, and her boyfriend is attacked and killed. Vicious attack in Central Park. And after that, she decides that she's going to get even with these people. And she basically jeopardises her whole career as a top talk show host on radio and sets about. And for someone who nothing, we're given the impression nothing nasty has ever happened to her in her life. And then all of a sudden she's decided she's going to fight back at these people. And oh, how convenient. She's in a convenience store when someone walks in and just shoots the woman behind the counter. It's that, that sort of thing. And so many stupid coincidences and so many stupid camera angles and just some absolutely banal dialogue. And it was just a huge, huge disappointment. I just thought, have you given up, Jodie? Have you really given up? Or did you just sign on to this purely because Neil Jordan was on board? Had you read the script? Had Neil Jordan read the script?
Did you need a new speedboat?
Well, it's not that. It's like, you know, have you done something horrendous here? Have you been threatened with something? Or have you been blackmailed, both of you, that you had to put your name to this film? It blows my mind. What a letdown.
But then wasn't she coming off Flight Plan, which wasn't the most intelligently plotted film in the world either?
Well, I didn't see Flight Plan, but you kind of get the feeling, though, that, you know, the Flight Plan, they have to do these ones every now and again, don't they? Where they have to take one for the team before they can make something more worthwhile. And you did have her in Spike Lee's Inside Man. She was in Inside Man. That was quite a good film. Yeah, in terms of films in which she's the lead player, though, you kind of feel like, okay, you had to do Flight Plan. You'd done Panic Room. Some people liked it. I didn't, but it seemed to get some sort of critical praise. You got Panic Room. We're giving you this, that, and they say, okay, right, we need you to take a hit. We need you to do Flight Plan. We know it's stupid, but yeah, no worries. We'll let you make something good after that. You can do another sort of prestige piece. Well, I know what I'll do. I'll do a Neil Jordan film. That sounds safe. Well, Jodie Foster, what have you done?
Not a great film, full of very, very silly bits, particularly when Jodie Foster, you know, she's after tragedy happens and she's scared to go out of her house, but to show that she's scared, every time she approaches the front door, the camera starts rocking back and forward like it's on the Titanic. You know?
And she immediately, having been refused sale of a gun in a gun shop, follows a man who stops in the street outside and says, "Psst, I heard you in there. Do you want to buy a gun? Because if you're afraid of blokes who you don't know after having just been attacked and set at death's door and your boyfriend being killed, what you would do is follow a complete stranger up an alley who says, "What, have you got $1,000 on you?" Yeah, I'm carrying $1,000. Right, follow me up this dark alley and I'll sell you a gun. Yeah. Wink, wink. Yeah, that's what would happen.
Also equally stupid plot-wise is the idea that for three quarters of the film, it doesn't occur to anybody that a woman could possibly be the culprit that they're looking for. So apparently women are too feeble to lift a handgun. It couldn't possibly have been her.
It just doesn't happen. That's just the most unbelievable element of the whole film. Women can't hold guns. Their delicate hands are more suited to washing dishes. Or at least that's probably what these guys would rather have you believe. But oh, it's just remarkable how bad a film it is, considering some of the talent involved. A real, real letdown. It also came to mind that perhaps maybe there are some films this year which weren't good enough to make our top 10, but they deserve special mention for some reason or another. Drew, is there a particular film you'd like to nominate?
There are a couple I'd like to mention, if you don't mind me mentioning more than one.
Oh, go on, sir.
First of all is Control, which we discussed in a previous podcast. It's not the most interesting of stories, in that Ian Curtis's life was quite short, actually. But it's such a beautifully shot film. It's one of the nicest looking films I've seen in quite some time. And for that point of view, it's not good enough story-wise to make my top 10. It's certainly very interesting. I'd urge people with any interest in cinematography to watch it.
So that wins the Drew Tavendale John F. Kennedy Award for being beautifully shot.
And the other two things I would just like to give mention to, simply for being one of the reasons being Scottish films, it's quite pleasant. Harlem Foe, which I still may not have made up my mind on, actually. I've changed my mind.
I thought you might mention this at some point, yeah.
I've changed my mind five or six times on whether I like this since I saw it in the cinema. And for that reason alone, it's probably worth seeing, because it might leave you thinking about it for a while. And so Jamie Bell does have some acting ability. Always, things like Billy Elliot always put me off, but I haven't seen him in things like Harlem Foe. There's a bit of a future there for him. And the other thing I'd like to give a mention to is The Flying Scotsman, which took about 10 years to come out, I think. It was a long time to get the funding together. Finally having come out, and it's really rather good and very interesting story of overcoming adversity to become world champion in cycling.
Excellent stuff. Scott, is there anything you'd like to give a particular mention to?
Again, I'll mention a couple from the kind of bubbling under list that are discounted that I don't think I've mentioned so far. Clint Eastwood's Letters from Iwo Jima, which I thought is a lot better than Flags of Our Fathers. I think
good call.
Quite a lot of people might have seen Flags of Our Fathers and just decided not to bother with Letters from Iwo Jima. It's a far superior film. I think that deserves a lot more exposure than it really got. I thought Stardust was a very excellent film. I thought
it's very enjoyable.
Yeah, as you were thinking, we were saying about Enchanted, it's a family film that actually I enjoyed, and I would put Stardust in that category. I thought it was an enjoyable little film. I'll also mention Idiocracy, which is the Mike Judge film, which is another, it was a reasonably funny comedy. It's not probably not good enough to bother a top 20 list even, but it's quite good. 28 Weeks Later, which manages the trick of being a horror sequel that's actually okay.
Well, I'd forgotten all about it, actually, yeah.
I mean, again, it's just a reasonable horror outing. It's not a patch on 28 Days Later, I don't think, but it's pretty good. I'll also mention Wrist Cutters, A Love Story, which is a very strange little tale about people who, having committed suicide, are then basically they're reincarnated onto Earth, but a slightly more miserable Earth, which seems like a cruel punishment for people who've killed their lives if they've seen too much misery. It's about one person's sort of tale to try and find love in this world, and it manages a trick of being quite bleak and quite charming at the same time, so that's another great film. I'll mention a film which I've not seen, but just because of the name, is The Itty Bitty Titty Committee, which is probably terrible, but just because it's the title, I just like saying it. So that's the Itty Bitty Titty Committee, the actual award, if you like. It's a film called Ex-Drummer, which got a very limited release. So it's basically an exercise in bad taste. This is about as well as I can put it. You've got three handicapped people who basically have formed a punk band and decide to ask a famous writer to join their band as a drummer. And then the writer then kind of manipulates them into doing various things so that he can write an interesting story about it. Quite a nasty film. It has full frontal nudity and people getting beaten up and homophobia and racism, and it's in terrible, terrible taste. It's one of these films, it's not actually good, but it's one of these kind of car wreck films that you watch just in bizarre fascination about how nasty things that are happening on screen is. It's a very strange film that's also trying to be a comedy as well. It's not actually particularly funny. It's a very strange thing. There always seems to be one comedy that's just bizarre that's entered in the film festival circuit. This is this year's entry. A very strange thing. It's worth seeing just to see the extent to which cinema can be pushed if you want to see it. If you think you're not easily offended by films, it's kind of worth seeing. But yeah, it's not a great film in any sense of the word, but it's certainly interesting.
We've already touched on 30 Days of Night, and I should probably add 28 Weeks Later to that as well for being, actually a very good horror film, which is hen's teeth these days. Zodiac we've already covered as well. I was going to give a mention to that for David Fincher having calmed down a bit. And the other great surprise to me this year was Die Hard 4.0, believe it or not, which, despite being crippled by being a four-quel in a year of three-quels, was also helmed by one Len Wiseman Esquire.
Still producing an involuntary shudder, that name.
Absolutely. Well, until Die Hard 4 came about, I thought he was most definitely a candidate for a retroactive abortion. If I'd come across him in the street, I would have happily stabbed him to death. I would have stabbed him to a bloody pulp. I would have killed him to bits, just as retribution for Underworld, and I haven't even seen Underworld 2. But by Jove, don't you know, Die Hard 4 was, it's a stupid film. Oh, it's a very stupid film, but it was massively entertaining. Yeah, and just in terms of sheer enjoyment, there wasn't a lot else other than the Bourne Ultimatum in terms of sort of frenetically paced action, which I enjoyed this year, but Die Hard 4.0 was up there, so I never thought I'd hear myself saying this, but well done, Len.
Definitely the best of the kind of franchise wars that was out around that time, but yeah, massively surprising. You could argue it's not really a Die Hard film, what with it all being all action all the time, which was never really John McClane's thing. He never seemed the kind of guy that would jump on top of a hovering plane, but in this one he is. The kind of buddy thing's a bit odd as well, but it's a very entertaining film, certainly, hampered only by Timothy Olyphant.
Yeah, who's terrible.
He's also Hitman. Yes. Well, I think unless we've anything else to mention, that just about wraps it up for our little review of the year that was 2007. Whether or not it should be tied up in a sack and thrown in the river, we'll leave that judgment to you. It certainly wasn't a quality year in the grand scheme of things, but hopefully you'll have listened to our little list of recommendations and realised that maybe it's not quite as bleak as a lot of people have made out. Next time we speak to you, we will be looking forward to 2008, and we'll be discussing some of the new releases that'll be sitting in your multiplex. But until then, thanks very much for listening. I've been Craig, as usual, in Liverpool, and Scott Morris, as always, joins us from Glasgow.
Goodbye.
And Drew Tavendale was joining us from Falkirk.
Bye-bye.
Keep it real. Speak to you soon. Bye.
The horror, the horror. I have got cotton wool in my cheeks.